This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UN Security Council's recent authorization of an international stabilization force, the ISF, in Gaza has sparked sharp contention. Supporters frame it as a transitional mission to secure a ceasefire, enable humanitarian relief, and prepare for reconstruction. Critics, though, including Palestinian resistance movements, denounce it as an infringement on self-determination, while the European Union warns against altering Gaza's demographic and territorial integrity and insists on a two-state solution. The spotlight now turns on whether the ISF represents genuine stabilization or a new form of external control. I am Bahman Roy. Let us begin with the report.
The UN Security Council has voted in favor of a U.S. plan for Gaza, including supporting the establishment and deployment of an international stabilization force. Under the adopted resolution, foreign troops will operate under a unified command to secure the territory, oversee its demilitarization, and facilitate aid delivery through safe corridors. The measure passed overwhelmingly. However, major powers, Russia and China, abstained, arguing that the resolution fails to outline a clear role for the UN in Gaza's future and lacks enough detail on how it will be implemented.
In essence, the Council is giving its blessing to a U.S. initiative on the basis of Washington's promises, giving complete control over the Gaza Strip to the Board of Peace and the International Stabilization Force, the modalities of which we know nothing about so far.
The draft resolution is vague and unclear on many critical elements. It should have explained in detail their structure, composition, terms of reference, and criteria of preparation, among others. This should have been an essential basis for the Council's serious discussions. However, the draft resolution contains skimpy details on these critical elements.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has also slammed the resolution, saying in a statement that it does not meet the political and humanitarian demands and rights of the Palestinian people. The group insisted that any international force must operate fully under UN supervision and only in coordination with official Palestinian institutions. Other resistance groups have expressed similar concerns, saying the resolution undermines Palestinians' right to self-determination and that it authorizes the U.S. to establish itself as an occupying power. The concerns are in line with repeated alarms that any initiative for the future of Gaza by the U.S. cannot be trusted by Palestinians. That's because Washington is widely known as an accomplice in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Betul Sobeti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. And Ajamu Baraka, founder of the Black Alliance for Peace, joining us from New York in the US. Welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you. I'm going to start the conversation with Betul here. Betul, how do Palestinian resistance movements interpret the ISF resolution as undermining their right to self-determination?
Let's talk about, you know, the demands of this, you know, so-called peace plan and this, you know, resolution. In terms of where Palestinian power lies, it talks about the reformation within the UN, within the PA. It talks about, you know, the reconstruction process of allowing aid in. The ISF is supposedly to train Palestinians to disarm the resistance, to destroy the tunnels. These powers will be introduced to the Palestinian side that they decide should take over when all is ready. And we've seen a lot of back and forth to make this palatable and acceptable. The crux of all of this is that America is the one that wants to arrange the structures in the way that they see fit. Now, what does America not want? They don't want any Palestinian formation that is independent. If we just put the resistance on the side for a moment, even the PLO, you know, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, that was formed by Yasser Arafat, which we had the PA that came out of Oslo, even that in its current form is rejected by America and the Israeli occupation entity, despite the fact that Israel itself was the signatory to the Oslo Accords. And we saw that Palestine fulfilled its side, but the Israeli occupation entity didn't fulfill their side. So the PA is rejected. You know, Israel reached a point of annexing the West Bank despite, you know, the Oslo Accord splitting it up into areas A, B, C, etc. And that goes to the heart of the matter, and that is because the PA was not their creation, despite the fact that the PA takes orders from the Israeli occupation entity and follows them. But ultimately, they want to form the authority in control. Of course, in all of this, the resistance is also rejected, which is inherently a part and parcel of the people. And the people have made their decision. We've seen it clear in the past 2 years from the people of Gaza that they stand with the resistance as well.
Right. I want to continue another conversation, bringing Ajamu to the conversation. Really, how can an externally mandated stabilization force, a so-called ISF, ever be legitimate without the consent of the people it is going to rule on?
It can't be. This is what makes this whole proposal so unserious, that this is a ideal that is bound to fail because it continues to sideline the representatives of the Palestinian people themselves. I think this will be a dark day in the history of the United Nations when it becomes clear, I think it's already clear, that the United Nations has basically allowed itself to be bullied by the United States of America into, in essence, surrendering its legitimacy and its power to the United States of America. This ideal that the U.S. should have the authority to, along with the Israeli fascists that created the genocide and continued the occupation, the idea that they should be allowed to govern a Palestinian people who are involved in a legitimate struggle of decolonization a struggle that is, has as its objective self-determination, it puts the United Nations on the side of the colonizer. This is an absolute departure from the values and the principles of the United Nations and its charter. So this is absolutely outrageous and should be rejected by most of the nations on this planet.
Right, and Batul, considering the different dimensions of this new resolution, which has gone past, you know, the UN Security Council, how much do you think it risks becoming a new form of trusteeship or colonial administration, you know, under international cover?
Ultimately, this goes to the crux of what we're seeing in the region. The whole region is colonized and not stabilized. This needs to be made clear. When we look at Gaza today, more than half of it is already occupied by Israel. So it's not a matter of the ISF risking becoming a colonial administration. The whole of Gaza is besieged today. If you look at even its neighbors, you look at Lebanon, you look at Syria, they're routinely bombed. You look at the Persian Gulf countries, you look at Egypt, you look at Saudi Arabia, they operate under a form of American colonialism in that they are under American dictates. Today, the whole region, this phase of U.S. colonization in the region is at its worst phase because America today is fully calling the shots in terms of how to deal, what is considered acceptable, what isn't. It seeks to get the world's countries to bow with different kinds of excuses. And if we look even beyond continents, from Venezuela to Cuba, using the excuse of the war on drugs, in Lebanon today, we see the American paper openly being called as such, and that it needs to be enacted under threats or else Lebanon will be invaded. Today, America is the one giving the dictates and outlining its visions and what it wants to be fulfilled. And we see those dictates, for example, I gave the example of Lebanon, being given to the Lebanese army that is funded by the US. You know, we see it canceling its scheduled meetings with the Lebanese army commander because, you know, Lebanon's statement is clearly blaming Israel for its tensions rather than the resistance.
Right.
But today, what we see is the political and military hegemony is from the US. The structures are theirs. The leadership is theirs, as they want it in Gaza, and they decide who fulfills what. So today in Gaza, they want to give the reconstruction to the Persian Gulf countries, the money from them. You have troops in the ISF, they're talking about troops from Islamic countries supposedly being integrated. They want to almost create a contradiction here between even Muslim governments and the people. So we see the decisions of the Security Council ultimately within this framework, which are all inherently colonial.
Right. Achamo, the UN, of course, it's called United Nations. It is supposed to be independent. How do you think it can reconcile stabilization with the principle of self-determination so enshrined in its own charter?
It's impossible. And that's really the point, that basically this is a significant departure from the United Nations charter. This is historic in its implications. And so, as the guest just indicated, this is a reflection of the new power dynamics that basically over the last 2 years, what we have seen unfold in West Asia has been a program of domination, a program that had at the center of its objective the reestablishment of U.S. hegemony in the region operating through its proxy, Fort Israel. And we the vote the other day in the United Nations was just a culmination of this process. So these principles cannot be reconciled, and that's why they are bound to fail. What is going to be the role of this international stabilization force if the resistance continues, and it will continue? Will they be given a mandate to go in shooting and murdering Palestinian people? This is something that it is unworkable. And again, it's something that we should reject. The only legitimate force that can be inserted is a force under the command of the United Nations with the full cooperation and permission given by the representatives of the Palestinian people themselves. Anything short of that is colonialization.
Right, and Batul, how will this ISF going to engage with de facto local authorities without legitimizing armed control or excluding constituencies?
Right. So within the UN resolution, I mean, there's several things, right? You have that Board of Peace, and then you have the ISF that's overseen by it. And the idea is that it would coordinate with Egypt and the Israeli occupation forces. And their job ultimately would be to train the Palestinians that they want and that they bring to then control the strip. So they are a police state, you know, made up of countries. And one of its jobs is to hit the existing infrastructure that they seek to get rid of. And you also have a Palestinian executive committee, this is outlined within the resolution, that manages the day-to-day governance within the Gaza Strip. So basically technocrats taking care of the civil administration of the state, again, in coordination between Egypt and the Israeli occupation entity. And within that, you have supporting nations like Qatar, Turkey, Egypt, and the US. One important point that I want to raise over here, when we talk about, you know, like the second phase, is, you know, even this 52% of Gaza that is occupied now by Israel, it is clear from this resolution that Israel will not withdraw and will not leave until there is this alternative force ready to govern within the American structure, American created. And all of this means that the second phase, including the withdrawal of the IOF, is hanging and is not bound by time, but by procedures that are very difficult to actualize, because its actualization includes removal of the Gazan resistance. And what does disarmament even mean? You know, what does it mean to destroy the tunnels? What could not be achieved during those 2 years of exercising the maximum degree of force it can apply on Gaza in terms of achieving its objectives? Israel will not be able to achieve during a time of peace. So it will not eliminate the resistance, no part of it, nor its supportive environment. And the mere existence and continuation of the idea and of those who carry the idea of resistance and who remain steadfast on this land means that even the political negotiations cannot replace the military force in extracting what is sought to be extracted. And in the ongoing and existing crisis in Palestine, that is, we're seeing a transformation occurring within the active internal situation that is rejecting this reality. For example, never at any point in time was the resistance able to recruit the number of fighters that it's able to recruit now.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Adjamo, I want to talk a little bit about the European Union. Well, the collective West seems to be of a unified stance when it comes to this resolution. But at the same time, the European Union has warned against any changes in the demographic or the territorial integrity of Gaza and Palestine. Where does this concern come from, do you think?
Well, I mean, it comes from their insistence on this fiction of a two-state solution. And I say fiction because the Israeli authorities have made it quite clear that they oppose any Palestinian state anywhere in the region. So where is the basis of peace, and where is the basis of a so-called two-state solution? So this is a continuation of Oslo, a continuation of the fiction that the European nations are committed to Palestinian rights in a Palestinian state. But the historic experience suggests to us that we can't really take them seriously, that basically they are in alignment with the interests of the U.S. They will articulate some concerns because of their attempts to try to continue to pretend to be the defenders of international law and human rights. But Gaza has exposed the true nature, not only of the Israeli occupation and the Israeli colonial project, but it stripped away any veneer that the West had any kind of commitment to anything called human rights and international law.
Right, Ajam, I want to continue this with you. You mentioned the two-state solution, which is like what the European Union wants and insists on. What, how do you think this two-state solution goes along with the transitional governance form and model that has been designated for this ISF?
It's impossible to, they can't reconcile these two ideals, because basically if you are not prepared to allow the Palestinians to exercise authentic self-determination, then there's no solution. There's no peace process. That's why it's a misnomer to even refer to this as a peace process. This is a demand for the surrendering of the Palestinian resistance. This is a demand that any aspirations for Palestinian self-determination be abandoned. What is unique about this process is that we have a situation developing where you have sort of a new creation of a whole colonial administration, that the Israelis have been almost forced to give up some degree of control over Gaza,
right,
to the interest of the United States of America.
Right. And Batul, I want to focus on Russia and China's role. And they abstained rather than like voting negative to this resolution. I want to talk. I want you to tell me, what do you think? How does this reflect wider concerns regarding the implementation and implications of this resolution on the future of Palestine?
Right. I mean, Russia and China abstaining, I mean, ultimately that means they, at the heart of it, were against this resolution. This resolution, but they don't have alternatives. And they also have reservations. Ultimately, this proves to me even more the point that, practically speaking, this plan of America will not work. And ultimately, that's because the Palestinians have proven that they will not accept to be besieged and occupied. And that's what October the 7th was a result of. But at the same time, no one should expect the liberation in Palestine to come from anywhere other than the Palestinians themselves. I mean, in 2 years of a genocide, we've not seen China reduce its trade relations with the Israeli occupation entity, which is its largest trade partner. I mean, in 2024 alone, like, the total goods trade between the entity and China was up to 16 billion, and it was up around 10% from 2023, and its imports actually rose in 2024. And likewise with Russia, I mean, Russia has its interests with the occupation entity too. You have its, you know, Zionist Jewish oligarchs within Russia. You've got over 1 million, you know, citizens of the Israeli occupation entity who also have Russian citizenship. So ultimately, it's shown that Russia and China are not willing to upset the United States of America when it comes to this. And they're almost waiting for the battle to come to their yard, if you will, in order to stand up and to take this kind of action. So ultimately, no liberation for Palestine will happen except at the hands of the Palestinians. And the Palestinians have proven that they are absolutely steadfast and they will not give up. And we know that occupations, transgressions, torture, besiegement, they're all tools of savagery that are practiced against the Palestinian nation so it can remain isolated and has nothing. But resistance emerging and solidifying itself is very natural. It's not natural for there to be no resistance based on the extent of the transgression that is occurring. And if we look at the results, I mean, the Oslo Accords happened 3 decades ago, and October the 7th happened 3 decades after it. So occupation will only breed resistance, and even international law itself gives legitimacy to armed resistance as a reaction to occupation. And ultimately, the whole world today is at a completely different place due to this confrontation. The world has woken up.
Right, Ajamo, I want to talk a little bit about the operational mechanics of this ISF ruling model. What mechanisms, with Egypt and Israel controlling the borders, will be there without entrenching external control over Palestinian free movement?
Well, I mean, the control will be total. And I'm more concerned about the so-called training of a force internally within the Gaza Strip by Egypt and the occupation forces, because that spells a force that would be completely in opposition to the Palestinian people themselves. There's nothing about this plan that makes any real sense, that these folks seem to be operating in an alternative universe. And you know, the very fact that we have to give this some time and some degree of legitimacy, you know, it just sort of compounds the fact that, you know, these forces have the ability to recreate reality, if you will. But in their attempt to do that, they devise processes and policies that undermine their own objectives. They're not going to be able to implement this plan, this so-called peace plan in Gaza. The history of anti-colonial struggles have supported that. So basically what we're going to see now is a continuation of the suffering of the Palestinian people. And we're going to see, I think, a certain kind of destabilization taking place, even in some of those states that have signed on to this fictional process.
Right, and it's very unfortunate, of course, to hear and to witness. Well, Batul, one final question for you. How will the mission ensure compliance with international humanitarian law and avoid actions resembling occupation?
Absolutely, and I echo exactly what the guest has just said. It's absolutely impossible to ascertain that because we've just had 2 years of genocide in which it was perpetrated by America that is putting this supposed peace plan forward. So the one that is orchestrating it ultimately is the one who perpetrated the genocide. It's crazy, right? They come under the guise of peace. So all of a sudden now they're talking about peace, whereas they were the proponents of the genocide. And now they're talking about reconstruction and making something out of Gaza when these weapons, Israel could not have conducted this genocide for one day without the American support. So it's absolutely impossible. And what do we expect to see? We expect to see further resistance and the Palestinians remaining steadfast.
Right, and one final question for Ajamu. Of course, will there be any independent bodies investigating alleged abuses by all actors, including the ISF?
There should be. I mean, this should fall under the authority, under the auspices of the United Nations Human Rights Council. You have, of course, the Special Rapporteur. So there should be, close scrutiny, because we anticipate nothing but the continuation of violence, not at the level of the last 2 years, perhaps, but violence nevertheless. And this is a situation that suggests to us that in the end, we're going to have an explosion, not only in Gaza itself, but across West Asia, when the masses of the people understand the collusion that their states have been involved in, collusion with the collective West against the Palestinian people, and the indignity of that, we're going to see, I think, massive political destabilization across West Asia.
Right, thank you so much. It was indeed a pleasure to have you on this program. Ajamu Baraka, founder of Black Alliance for Peace, joining us from New York, and Batul Sobeti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. Now, the ISF in Gaza embodies a profound tension, stabilization for some, colonialization for others. This spotlight leaves open the question of whether international intervention can truly secure peace without eroding Palestinian sovereignty. Thank you, Ayan Bahman Roy.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to all our listeners. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Bookshelf, and I'm Nasreen Sayed. Today, we are going to be talking about a book called Our Missing Hearts, by Celeste NG. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to grow up in a world where fear shapes every rule, every law, every action, where speaking the truth or asking questions can put your family at risk? Our Missing Hearts by Celeste NG tells the story of 12-year-old bird gardener, who lives quietly with his father, a once brilliant linguist now reduced to shelving books in a university library. In their world, silence is survival. For the past decade, laws have been enforced in the name of protecting American culture. Families who question authority, especially those of Asian heritage, live under suspicion, and children can be removed from their parents. Even libraries have been forced to strip their shelves of books deemed dangerous, including the poetry of Bird's mother, Margaret, who vanished when Bird was 9. Bird has learned not to ask about his mother, not to read her words, not to wonder why she left. But when he receives a mysterious drawing in the mail, he's pulled into a quest that takes him back through the folk tales she once told him, into the hidden world of underground librarians, and finally to New York City, where the possibility of reunion collides with a quiet act of resistance. The novel wrestles with powerful themes, the endurance of love, the resilience of art, and the way stories carry truth, even when voices are silenced. At its heart, it's about the sacrifices parents make for their children and the courage it takes to defy fear, when fear itself can become law. Engie captures the tension between personal integrity and societal pressure, showing how one small act of courage can ripple outward, even in the darkest times. At its core, the philosophy of Our Missing Hearts is clear. Authenticity and moral courage are essential, even in societies that punish truth-telling. Personal identity and integrity can exist even under immense pressure, and love and art themselves can be acts of resistance. Bird's journey reminds us that protecting what is most precious, family, freedom, truth, requires not only courage, but also creativity, resilience, and hope. After the break, we will read a part of this book.
IRIB English Radio.
The letter arrives on a Friday, slit and resealed with a sticker, of course, as all their letters are inspected for your safety. Packed. It had caused confusion at the post office, the clerk unfolding the paper inside, studying it, passing it up to his supervisor, then the boss. But eventually it had been deemed harmless and sent on its way. No return address, only a New York NY postmark, 6 days old. On the outside, his name Bird. And because of this, he knows it's from his mother. He has not been Bird for a long time. We named you Noah after your father's father, his mother told him once. Bird was all your own doing. The word that when he said it felt like him. Something that did not belong on earth. A small, quick thing, an inquisitive chirp, a self that curled up at the edges. The school hadn't liked it. Bird is not a name, they said. His name is Noah, his kindergarten teacher, fuming, said. He won't answer when I call him. He only answers to Bird. Because Bird is his name, his mother said. He answers to Bird. So I suggest you call him that. Birth certificate be damned. She had taken a Sharpie to every handout that came home, crossing off Noah, writing Bird on the dotted line instead. That was his mother, formidable and ferocious, when her child was in need. In the end, the school conceded, though after that, the teacher had written Bird in the quotation marks, like a gangster's nickname. Dear Bird, please remember to have your mother sign your permission slip. It wasn't until he was 9 after his mother left that he became Noah.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Once in Harvard Square, Bird and his father had run into Sarah, who lived 2 houses down, who had sometimes brought them rhubarb muffins and borrowed Margaret's pruning shears. She crossed the street as they approached casually, but quickly, as if there were a bus she needed to catch. The next time they saw her on their own street hauling in garbage cans after the truck had gone, she didn't meet their eyes. Worse than the neighbors who ignored them, the ones who began to check on them. To see if you needed anything, one would say. Just dropping by to see how you were doing, to see how you were holding up. What was it they were supposed to be holding up? Bird wondered, though eventually he realized it was themselves. It did feel that way in those early days, on the mornings when he'd learnt to eat his cereal dry, because the milk in the fridge always seemed to have curdled. Like they were puppets and the strings holding them up had gone slack. His mother had done all those things, but she was gone, and they would have to learn to survive on their own. A near impossible thing those first weeks. When the smoke alarm went off, the fire department arrived, and his father had to explain. No, everything was fine, just the pancakes left in the pan too long. Yes, he knew the stove should never be unattended. Bird had called him into the other room. No, Bird was perfectly safe. Everyone was under control. Another afternoon, Bird fell off his bike at the corner and skinned both his knees and ran back home, screaming, blood trickling down both shins. He was sitting on the closed toilet, sniffling, his father dabbing at him with a damp paper towel. It's okay, Bird. See, just a scrape. Not bad as it seems. When the police arrived, a neighbor had called, the little boy crying and alone, the bike abandoned, front wheel still spilling. Just wanted to make sure he wasn't unattended, you know, with his mother gone. Weeks after Bird's 9th birthday, over breakfast, Ethan had suddenly paused, stunned, and set his phone before her, heads bent over the screen. They'd read the headline together. Conflict erupts at protest. 6 injured, 1 dead. Below, a photo of a young black woman, long braids pulled back in a ponytail, glasses, yellow hat, still standing, eyes still clear and open, mouth still parted in a cry. A millisecond before her mind knows what her body already feels. A red rose of blood just starting to bloom on her chest. Clutching in her hands a poster, "All Our Missing Hearts," and a caption, "Protester Mary Johnson, 19, a first-year student at NYU from Philadelphia, was killed by a stray bullet in police response to anti-pact riots Monday." The first of many such articles, but they would all use the same photo. This young woman, Mary, had read Margaret's book in her dorm room. She was studying developmental psychology, planning to become a pediatrician. And with each news report of a child taken, the last lines of the last poem had come back to her, insistent as an infant's cry. After PACT's passage, there were more and more of them. The few that made the news here and there framed as stories of negligence and endangerment. The parents portrayed as reckless and careless and callous. But others too, shrouded in rumour and secrecy and shame. Just rumours. Some people scoffed. Replacements happened only in a few isolated cases. Others insisted PACT removals were a necessary evil, a rescue for the child's good and society's. Others insisted PACT removals were a necessary evil, a rescue for the child's good and society's. "Can't rock the boat," one commenter wrote online, and "be surprised when your kids gets washed overboard." But for every child you heard was taken, how many families said nothing, stopped protesting, stopped everything, hoping their good behavior would earn their children back? The night before the march, Mary bought sheets of poster board at the drugstore with fat-tipped scented markers. She jigsawed words onto a sign, sketched the solemn face of a child below. After the march, they found the markers and the rest of the poster board on the floor of her dorm, blank and unused, besides a spread eagled copy of Margaret's book. After that, vigils, campaigns to remember Mary online. Thousands of people changed their profile photos, Mary after Mary after Mary, a sea of them crying out, flushed with youth and fury and pulsing lost life, every one of them brandishing the poster with Margaret's words. We have been reading from Our Missing Hearts by Celeste NG. We hope you enjoyed our story. You've been listening to The Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. We hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
Iran is known for its four-season climate and the climatic variety in each of its regions. This time, the lavender fields of North Khorasan province have invited us so that we could discover a part of natural beauties in northeastern Iran.
This is a land of a thousand colors, with a wild and vibrant nature, where kings and poets have been inspired by its beauties throughout the ages. A place where fountains keep the rivers flowing like the never-ending tales of Shahrazad in the 1,000 Nights and a Night.
From some of the most arid deserts in the world, the habitat of the Iranian cheetah, to the greenest forests, pastures, and valleys, North Khorasan has it all. Here at the Baba Aman Forest Park, the combination of rivers, waterfalls, and the umbrella of sycamore trees have all created one of the most popular summer hideouts for the people in the region.
There are a number of forest parks in North Khorasan, and Baba Aman is one of the popular ones. In spring and summer, Baba Aman hosts the largest number of visitors. At first sight, the place resembles an oasis. What greets you here upon your arrival is the cool, gentle breeze that touches your face. The symphony of a flowing river and the terraced ponds in the middle of the park complete this good feeling. But our trip to North Khorasan is not all about nature. In this amazing region of Iran, there is a little town which could be considered unique, at least in Iran and its surrounding countries. The exceptional feature of this place unveils itself after a short drive in the town's only boulevard.
We have come to a little town in northeast Iran, a town with only 12,000 inhabitants. What is interesting about it is that it has more than 170 shops that only sell dried nuts and dried snacks, such as this one, which is called kashk. It's a combination of dried curd and herbs and spices.
Welcome to Faruj, the region's trade hub for dried nuts, trail mixes, and you name it.
One of the things that makes North Khorasan exceptionally beautiful is its untouched natural environment. Many believe that this region could be one of the main destinations for ecotourists in the near future. A few kilometers from the city of Shirvan, a village known as Gelian testifies to this fact.
We head towards a hidden paradise in Iran's northeast. Gelian, also known as Golian, is one of the 365 outstanding tourist villages of Iran. With a population of no more than 700, the inhabitants of this picturesque mountainous area are mainly engaged in farming and animal husbandry. Gelian is situated in a valley. The terraced structure of the village and its adobe buildings, along with very tall trees, are only some of the interesting features of this place. Some people believe that if you're born in Iran and spend an entire lifetime traveling across this country, you still wouldn't be able to see all the beauties of this ancient land. This may be true, but seeing at least a part of beautiful Iran would still be worth it. Amir Mehdi Kazemi for Iran.
The nomads follow a complete natural lifestyle. They are self-sufficient in many things, including many of the things they wear and what they eat, like this fatir bread with a taste of nature.
For us city dwellers, it may be hard to imagine living in conditions like this. But this is how the nomads live. These people are so determined. Life is not a joke around here.
Local sports and games are an inseparable part of every culture. Here in North Khorasan province, there is a type of wrestling which is extremely popular among the people. The locals say that it is one of the most ancient sports in the world. It is a part of every festivity and cultural event. It's known as wrestling with chukhe.
In addition to Iran, wrestling with chukhe is practiced in other countries as well, including Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and the Russian Republic of Tatarstan. But North Khorasan is known to be the birthplace of the sport. History has it that chukhe wrestling was a yardstick by which a wrestler's power and sense of heroism was put to the test. Chukhe is in fact the name of a vest which the wrestlers put on during the match. It is made of a thick cotton fabric and is considered as one of the most famous handicrafts of North Khorasan. North Khorasan is well known for its exclusive handicrafts, which shape a part of the people's culture in this part of Iran. Nargol Heydarian has been awarded several times for her lifetime achievements in reviving some of the forgotten traditional handicrafts of North Khorasan. Nargol currently holds an Academy of Traditional Handicraft in the city of Shirvan. Her goal is to help pass on her art and knowledge to young artists. Traveling around North Khorasan is like soaring among the pages of an old storybook in your dreams.
To the people in North Khorasan, preserving cultural identity is of great importance. That's why, regardless of their age and ethnicity, they spare no effort in passing on their heritage to future generations. I'm Amir Mehdi Kazemi, reporting for Iran.